Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, we have an extremely crowded week this week.
Me too.
Six films. I only saw five, and it sounds like you saw 5.8.
Yes.
And you brought we're doing this actually a little bit earlier. Usually we do this on a Friday night, therefore we pop open a bottle of wine, because who cares, it's Friday night. We're doing this on a Wednesday night, because we have things to do.
Spring break.
I didn't feel like drinking tonight. And you said, you had this perfect idea, and you've been shuffling over there. I haven't been peeking. What are we drinking tonight?
We are drinking. I think it's Gatorade of some sort, but you can figure out the reason for this particular drink to go with our first movie.
I didn't at first, but it took me 2 seconds.
Seconds too long.
It's actually about our first film, because this is Gatorade, and it's called Cool Blue. Cool Blue because Smurfs are blue.
And this is, like, I actually found the Gatorade that matches the color of the Smurfs. It's not just any blue.
It matches pretty well.
It is Smurf
cheers.
Blue.
Thank you
cheers.
For the cool blue Gatorade.
You bet. Didn't clink very well because it's plastic, but, you know.
It tastes good, though. All right,
lovely vintage.
Let's go ahead and start with another animated film. We had one last week with The Boss Baby, which ended up winning the weekend. It beat Beauty and the Beast.
Wow.
Made $50 million, way more than anyone thought it would make, and it won the weekend.
Yeah, I was surprised, but surprised and not surprised at the same time, because these family movies
very
well.
Beauty and the Beast should have still, I thought, taken.
Yeah, it should have still held on a little bit more, but Boss Baby,
Alec Baldwin.
Do not underestimate Alec Baldwin. I think he is riding the wave right now of his popularity. And this movie did throw a few bones at the adults. And so I think people had seen the trailer and were interested enough to go see it. Unlike necessarily the Smurfs movie.
The Smurfs, so the Boss Baby had adult jokes in it. The Smurfs does not. Actually, no. It has zero adult jokes. And my kid enjoyed it. And I was like, okay, it's kind of, it is and it's not reminiscent of the cartoon in the 80s. So this is the third Smurf movie in the last, like, 5 years. The first two were hybrids. You had some animated Smurfs, and they were in the real world. There were real people. There was, like, one in 2011. It might have involved Neil Patrick Harris. I don't know. I didn't see them.
I missed them, too.
But this one is all animated, all computer graphics, so it's not hand animation. And its director is Kelly Asbury from Shrek 2. The gentleman behind Shrek 2 is behind Smurfs, The Lost Village. And so if you're thinking of Smurfs, tell me if you agree with these themes that I think there are themes of teamwork to bring everyone together,
mm-hmm.
accepting of each other's differences.
Of course.
Because these are not three-dimensional Smurfs. There's Brainy Smurf. There's Clumsy Smurf. I wonder what these characters are like. And my favorite, Nosy Smurf.
Nosy was my favorite, too. We
What's
agree
going
on that.
On in
because
here?
I love Nosy, because Nosy would just be that wanderer that would just kind of steal a scene once in a while and just kind of be cruising through and peeking in the windows and just be like, what's going on?
And his catchphrase, well, all right.
I know. I we agree on that. So we already have some common ground
Smurf.
Because Nosy Smurf was my
favorite.
And
don't overdo it. He's a minor character.
He's totally minor, which is probably why I liked him.
Smurfs The Lost Village is a Smurfette story. I had no idea about Smurfette's backstory. That Gargamel created her out of clay and that she wasn't actually not a real Smurf. I had no idea.
Me either.
So unlike the cartoon in the 80s, where they were kids. These Smurfs were kids. There was Papa Smurf and a bunch of kids. These are like preteens now. They are hefty. He's at least noticing the opposite sex. He's always kind of making a little innuendo towards Smurfette. And they're skateboarding and whatever boarding. And they're preteens.
Yeah.
They're older.
It's a little weird to follow, though, the relationship, because there's Papa Smurf and they all live sort of together.
Do not think about the...
Wasn't it there, though?
Is it patriarchal? Is it?
Yes.
Are they all as children?
It's like, are they supposed to be siblings, but then one's got the hots for the other one? I don't know. It was a little weird to me.
So I didn't realize this until late. So right at the end, Gargamel... He's like, okay, he's going to have his moment. He might actually finally get to eat him some Smurfs, because that's his whole, he wants to eat some Smurfs and steal their power and have, like, long Elvis hair or whatever. He's about to win, and my kid leans over and he says, Dada, I don't like this movie. And because he was afraid, because in his mind, he's four, he does not know the heroes always win. He honestly thought Gargamel could win this, and he was like, why am I watching a movie where the bad guy wins? So I had to lean over. It's okay. It's okay. Smurfette's going to come soon. It's okay. Lesson learned for me, kids like that think the bad guy can win.
Yeah, well, they take it all very literally, and as it comes, they take it. And so they don't have the context of knowing that every single one of these animated movies that are designed for the kid audience will ultimately end in a way that will make it okay for the kids. You can always get through those bad parts. But this is just a kid movie. I mean, there is not anything that makes it in any way also enjoyable on an adult level. It's like watching a Saturday morning cartoon version with your kids.
It's as deep as that with celebrity voices.
And with celebrity voices, but without the music that should have been in it. I was
the Smurf song's not in there.
There's nothing. There is no soundtrack. And yet you've
got... There is a soundtrack. That god-awful Meghan Trainor song is in there.
So you've got this Meghan Trainor song that comes out at the end. It's like part of the closing credits that is the most enjoyable, to me, 2 minutes of the movie. But the fact that you have Demi Lovato as the Smurfette voice and you've got Mandy Patinkin as Papa Smurf, you have two incredibly voice talents in this movie. Figure out a way to come up with a duet for Papa Smurf and Smurfette. There's nothing in this movie. It's like Trolls without the music. And that's what made Trolls work and made Trolls fun for people. Smurfs was just lacking, to me, the fun factor.
Yeah, there's a... put it maybe on the same tier as Rock Dog, perhaps. Rock Dog wasn't for adults either. There's another 30 Rock tie-in. Remember last week, Alec Baldwin had that 30 Rock tie-in and is kind of playing his character? Mm-hmm. Clumsy Smurf is voiced by Jack McBrayer, the page from 30 Rock. Kenneth.
Absolutely.
A clumsy guy, kind of.
Yeah, he is the most even physically reminiscent, like the one character that's drawn that you immediately think of Kenneth from 30 Rock while you're watching him. He just has a naturally animated voice.
And there's a voice I didn't learn until I looked at the credits. I had no idea it was... No spoilers here, but there's a Smurf called Smurf Willow. She's kind of, Julia Roberts.
Yes.
I had no... It didn't sound like her. I didn't pick up on it.
I didn't either. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So it's got some really good voiceover talent, but the movie itself is kind of lame.
Oh, skip this movie. Unless your kid's like, I gotta go see Smurfs. And yeah, there's nothing objectionable. Take them there.
But if you haven't seen Boss Baby yet... Go see that one first.
If you're an adult, steering towards that, you'll have a much better time at
Absolutely.
Boss Baby.
Absolutely.
All right, the next one is also a big blockbuster wide release this weekend, and I was movied out. I messaged you, like, I'm not coming tonight. Yours is all you. Please tell us about, I don't even remember the name.
Was it Going in Style?
Going in Style. Tell us about Going in Style.
Going in Style is a remake of a 1979 movie that had George Burns in it. And I vaguely recall that movie. So I think I might have seen it. But it is, if you had to draw a parallel to something current, I would say it's like watching Hell or High Water as a geezer heist comedy.
I don't like you comparing this to Hell or High Water.
Well, but the idea is that you've got these, you have these three old retirees played by Morgan Freeman, Alan Arkin, and Michael Caine. Mm. And so it's like a dream team, a dream cast for the mature audience movies. It
the
really
AARP
is.
Audience
yes,
coming out
it
for this
really
one.
Is. And so it's these three retirees who decide that they are going to rob the bank that has essentially robbed them of their pensions. And so they try to pull off this heist. And it felt a lot like they were phoning it in, but having such fun with it that you kind of just, you go along for the ride. This is not a great movie, but it's one of those ones that feels very much like you'd watch it on an airplane or you'd rent it and you'd just be like, that was cute. It's got some poignant moments and, you know, that sort of end of life or final chapter kind of thing going on and, reclaiming their lives in their old age and deciding, not even old age. I mean, I think they're supposed to be 70s, early 80s, maybe. And so what happens is that the Michael Caine character, his house is about to be foreclosed on. And so he goes to the bank initially to just sort of fight the foreclosure. And while he's there, the bank gets robbed. And he realizes just how simple it seemed for the bank to be robbed. And so he takes that as a sign that in order to save his home from foreclosure from these evil bankers, that he is going to get his two buddies. And what do they have to lose? Because even if they got life in prison, they figured they don't have that many years left. And at least they'd have a roof over their heads and three square meals a day. So that's kind of their thinking. And it's just, it's sweet. And
did you laugh?
I chuckled throughout, you know, in spurts. It's not a ha-ha laugh-out-loud comedy throughout, but it has enough funny, sweet moments to get you through.
Is the scheme to rob the bank witty?
There are a couple of little twists near the end that make it work. It's witty in that you've got these three witty guys. Alan Arkin provides sort of that comic relief.
He gets the one-liners.
He gets the one-liners, which he almost always does. Michael Caine is the one who's the mastermind of this plan. If anyone was taking their role truly seriously, even in its comedic twist, it's Michael Caine. Alan Arkin and Morgan Freeman just seem to be along for the ride, and they're all going to have fun being able to work together on this movie. Oh, and the biggest surprise, do you know who directed this movie?
Blow my mind.
Zach Braff.
That does blow my mind.
When his name popped up at the end.
He does Garden State.
As the director.
He does Wish You Were Here or Wish I Was Here.
Yeah. That's, so he, I don't know.
Zach Braff.
Yeah. So it's directed by Zach Braff. So... Harmless movie, dream team for the older crowd in terms of the actors. You are going to see this for the same reason that people might have gone to see Shirley MacLaine, you know, doing her thing. This one, it's Alan Arkin doing his Alan Arkin.
Most importantly, what would I have said? Walking out of the theater.
You would have been in slight pain. Not in as much pain as you appeared to be coming out of this next one we'll talk about. But for the most part, I do think that now do you understand why Hell or High Water is a good comparison in terms of the general plot where you had these unlikely bank robbers?
I still don't like you comparing it to Hell or High Water, my favorite film of 2016.
I know, but if you had to put a gloss over it and go, okay, take Hell or High Water and take these three veteran actors and put them in a comedy together
It's a Woody Allen film. It's called Small Time Crooks. It's from the 90s. Oh, yeah. We'll give it that one.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. The next one that you were alluding to that I was kind of in pain, it's called Gifted. And I looked at this. I thought it was going to be released across America on like 3,000 screens, like Going in Style. It's being released on 50 screens.
You're kidding. Oh,
is this a slow opener?
I think 50 so.
Screens.
It's got to grow from there.
Even every state doesn't get one, probably.
It is the chick flick of the week.
So I'm going to tell the spoiler why it's chick flick. It stars...
Chris Evans. Captain America, baby. Yeah.
You know, and some of us are able to look beyond that and see there's a film underneath here. Some of us can't get past his... you know, shirtless torso.
No, no, no. It's not that at all. It's that you are getting past the fact that it's not necessarily all that great of a movie because Chris Evans is so watchable in it. And so if you need a reason to go see this movie, the reason is Chris Evans.
Well, it's directed by a man named Mark Webb, and that surprises me because he directed my favorite film of 2009, a film I'm still not over yet. I still can't even watch it again. 500 Days of Summer.
Oh, yes.
I
like that movie.
It's one of my favorite films of that decade. But then they saw, okay, this man knows how to make a film. Let's give him some blockbusters. So he did the two Amazing Spider-Man reboots with Andrew Garfield.
Which were also very good.
Looks like he got a sour taste in his mouth. He descended a couple levels to Gifted.
He didn't descend. We made the reference coming out of this movie that this movie feels like a Nicholas Sparks movie that has a kid and a one-eyed cat.
And the quirk, not the trick, but the unexpected thing is that the smart people in this movie, the geniuses in this movie, are all women.
Yes.
Interesting. You know,
not a quirk at
all. It shouldn't shock me, but, you know, it's not... You know, Good Will Hunting was a dude. They just don't usually make... Bobby Fischer, you know.
Beautiful dude. Mind. Anytime you think of these mathematicians, it's always a guy. It's generally a guy.
But no, the math geniuses in this film are both women. And there's a duo on screen. Chris Evans, he's the uncle. He's Frank. And there's little McKenna Grace as Mary. She's supposed to be 7 years old, I think.
Six and a half.
They have a very good... I'm gonna give this movie a compliment. They have a very good rapport. They have some good comedy scenes back and forth. Mm-hmm. They each have to do some heavy lifting crying scenes that are manipulative, but they, you know, acting-wise, were believable.
Absolutely, and she reminded me a lot of, like, a young Drew Barrymore or Dakota Fanning, like, in their early roles. She actually kind of brings that.
I can see that.
And so I did, like... Yes, granted, the emotion manipulation was very blatant, but people fell right into it. The sniffling.
Oh, man.
There was a lot of sniffling going
audible.
On.
Audible.
Audible sniffling near the end of this movie. And Octavia Spencer's in there in a very limited role for her.
Her name is Roberta, and she is wasted. Her whole reason in life is to give Frank the business and react. You did what? Oh my goodness, let me react to that. And I compare her to the movies where she actually had three dimensions. The Help.
Yeah.
Hidden Figures. And what is she doing here? She's cardboard.
It's an odd choice. She must have just had some particular reason for just wanting to be involved in this movie because it is, she doesn't have much to do. But she's good in her little role and then... The whole concept is it's a custody battle movie, and so you've got the uncle, Frank, who has been taking care of this little girl since his sister committed suicide several years before, and she's a child prodigy in math, but he's been homeschooling her, and he suddenly decides, you know what, I need her to be socialized, to be with other kids. He puts her into a public school, and that's kind of how it... how their existence starts to unravel a bit because the fact that she's this math genius comes out and the school is, you know, wants to have her go into like more of a gifted and talented school. And word gets back to the grandmother, who is also a math genius, and she suddenly wants to reclaim her grandchild and turn her basically into the same person that her mother was before she killed herself. And so Frank is trying to prevent a repeat of history, and they end up in court battling for custody over the child, Mary. This is where the movie went a little off the rails for me. I did not think that the custody fight, the legal stuff, made all that much sense. There were a lot of plot holes there. There were decisions made about her future that I don't think would have been made the way they are in this movie.
Gifted solely exists for the courtroom scenes, so each character in turn can get their moment on the stand of bearing their soul and ending up crying, and this is why I feel the way I do. Frank is a boat repairman, a superior father figure, a non-practicing philosophy professor with a heart of gold.
Yes.
And he's juxtaposed. He's set beside his mother, Evelyn, who they actually really try to make out as a true villain.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, they'll introduce her as an evil character, and then they'll do a switch. Maybe by the end you could see things from her point of view, get some empathy. And they never do that. They never walk her back.
I disagree. I think they walked her back for a little while. And so you were thinking that it was going to go one way. And I felt that when she spent time with Mary one-on-one, that they were building a little bit of a bond. And so I was thinking that if they came up with some compromise, it would all work out in the end in terms of their relationship. And so I disagree. I do think that that you felt some empathy for Evelyn at certain points. And that's where this movie succeeds in having you kind of have to shift gears once in a while. Again, Chris Evans is just the reason to see this movie. I love how it's a bit contrived that he starts a relationship with Mary's teacher, which you see that coming from about 10 miles away. The fact that the teacher and her colleagues all recognize Frank, the Chris Evans character, as being that, I think they're like, he's that hot, the damaged hot guy in the bar, you know? And so they all want to help fix him and help him. And he is, that's what he comes off as, a little bit like, a much lighter, Manchester by the Sea.
What are you doing? You're comparing Going in Style to Hell or High Water. Now you're comparing Gifted to Manchester by the Sea.
It's not.
Shame on you.
No, I mean, it's.
Just
it's,
shame on you.
No, I think if you're trying to kind of figure out the kind of characters they are, it's a much easier.
No, he has nothing in common with Casey Affleck's character.
Casey Affleck's character is the guardian of.
True pain, not Chris Evans.
It was, right. So Manchester by the Sea is a much heavier, way better movie. I'm not saying that this is on par. I'm not saying it's on par with that. I'm just saying if you want to kind of understand where the
I don't understand. I can't even kind of understand. No, I cannot kind of understand.
Because you already had it set in your mind that you were going to hate this
movie. Well, so we'll disagree on that point. We'll disagree on the Evelyn character. I want to talk about the setting. We both thought, oh, this is Nicholas Sparks. It's got to be North Carolina. And for the longest time, I thought it was. But actually, no, they were saying it was Tampa, suburbs of Tampa. They name-dropped Pinellas County. In fact, I think it was supposed to be St. Pete. And so I looked it up. No, they filmed it in Savannah, Georgia. Just like Ben Affleck's Live by Night. They both are set in, that one was set in Ybor City. And Tampa and the surrounding swamps, but no, they're both shot in that coastal Savannah area of Georgia, which I guess now cinema says, oh, it's just like Tampa and St. Pete.
Interesting, because I do like this movie better than Live by Night.
I did not go into this movie with an agenda. I didn't go in saying I was going to hate it. I knew it was going to be manipulative, and it met my expectations. It was manipulative, and it's not good. It's not good.
It met my expectations, and it was... I love Fred.
Fred the
one-eyed cat is a scene stealer. If I can also give you that one, that if I had to pick a scene stealer.
A best actor?
So we are good. We're nosy Smurf, we've agreed on.
Yeah.
And one-eyed cat Fred, we agree on.
Well, I want to give you another comment. I'm killing this Gatorade right now. We should do this every week. I feel so refreshed. This is great.
It's proven hydration with electrolytes, so it gets us through the six movies that we're trying to get through.
It's liquid Smurf is what it is.
It is.
All right, our next film is actually my favorite of the week, and it's not all in French. It's only half in French, and it's called France, and it's by a Frenchman. His name is François Ozon, and I was going through, you know what, I realized he's like France's Woody Allen. He turns out one a year. I didn't realize how many of his films I'd seen until I looked at his filmography, and I was like, I've seen 7 or 8 of his movies. The most recent one was 2014's The New Girlfriend. That made my top 5 foreign films of the year that year. And the others I saw while I was living in England. But his most famous ones are probably Swimming Pool with Charlotte Rampling back in 2003, uh-huh. 8 Women, what was that? Catherine Deneuve was in that, and before that, Under the Sand, another Charlotte Rampling one. So he's been around. People know this guy's name. It won a César just a couple weeks ago for Best Cinematography. I wonder if you, could you see why this won for Best Cinematography?
Not only can I see why, I actually like this one.
What?
I hate to break it to you. Even though it was French and German with English subtitles, I was completely absorbed by this one. It is what I would call an arty chick flick. And it felt like a throwback to like a 1930s or 40s kind of movie.
Interesting you should say that.
Black and white.
I will clear that up why.
Partially black and white, partially color. I was not very clear on why certain scenes were black and white. I'm sure there is a reason that you will now expound on for me, Charlie.
Well, the movie was originally a play, and it was written right after World War One. By a man named Maurice Rostand. And it was already filmed. It was adapted into a movie in 1931 by Ernst Lubitsch. The movie was called Broken Lullaby. We know Ernst Lubitsch. He did Shop Around the Corner with Cary Grant and Ninotchka, I think, with Garbo. He's like a screwball comedy guy. So this is actually an adaptation, but Ozon rewrote it for the point of view. In the play, in the first movie, it was from the Frenchman's point of view. It was from Adrien's point of view. He has a secret. We cannot tell the audience what that secret is.
Right.
He's a Frenchman. He survived the trenches of World War I. Just the next year after the war ends, he takes the train up to Germany. A very brave thing for a man to do. Because even though, you know, Germany, as we all now all think of the villains of that war, started the war, lost the war, they hate the French. Hate the French. So he goes up to this small town in Germany, and he's, you know, verbally abused, emotionally abused, because he wants to meet... He wants to... I don't know what he wants to be. He wants to atone. He's sad. France is dead. France died in the war. We don't know his connection to France, but he meets France's... fiancé
and parents.
Anna. Her name is... She's played by Paula Beer, by the way. She won Best Young Actress at the Venice Film Festival, and I can see why.
Yeah.
And she's eligible for Best Young Actor in our awards. She filmed this when she was 20.
Wow.
So she is completely eligible. It's in black and white, except for like three scenes, like a Schindler's List thing. And I thought it was because when they're thinking about the war, when they're talking about the war, it's in black and white. But there are certain sections when they go by a lake, then I think they don't think about the war at that point, and it turns to color. And I thought, okay, good metaphor, love it. Turns out it was for budgetary reasons.
Oh!
He didn't have any money to make this movie.
That is so sad, because I kept thinking, I was trying to figure out where's the shift. Why? I thought that it was every time they were doing flashbacks to scenes with France and the Frenchman.
Adrien.
That's when it was in color initially. I thought every time you'd see France... you would see in color. But then that changed.
So he did not...
Oh, well.
He didn't have money for production design. So he couldn't make it look like 1919 when this is set. So he found these villages in East Germany that had not been bombed in the war, so they did not need to be reconstructed after the war, and that somewhat still could pass for 1919. But if it was in color, you could tell. Like, it's not 1919. So he went black and white, so you couldn't tell.
So it's really hard to explain this movie without giving anything away, but it really is a very moving film, and it is very much a chick flick. There is a...
It is not a chick flick.
I think it was.
What are you talking about?
I'm telling you, it's an arty chick flick. It is a movie
that... It's not a chick flick.
It has... It does. It's got these... There's like a bit of a love triangle thing that's kind of going on, and there's really good, interesting chemistry. The guy who played Adrien, I was not buying into his appearance and demeanor and potential relationship with Anna at first, but he totally grew on me, and I thought there really was an interesting chemistry between these leads. And the story with how he interacts with France's parents, who are just looking, you know, here they had lost their son in the war, and they're looking for anybody to talk to who knew their son and who knew their son in France and can give them some insight into their son's final days and final years. And so they just take to this stranger, and it makes for a very fascinating dynamic. And it goes differently than you would expect at the end. And so I appreciated this movie on a lot of levels. I think it's actually going to make it into my, certainly probably near the top of my foreign films for the year.
France's parents and even Anna, at first, they idealize Adrien. He's healing their psyche. They were starving for this because they were just going through the motions of living before he arrived. And he encounters some blatant nationalism. The Germans are still in their pubs. You know, they're not doing Heil Hitler yet because he doesn't exist, but they're singing their fatherland songs, and they are hostile to him. And you could see the seeds of World War II already in there. They're itching to go back to war already, even though it just ended last year. Some people do not like the second half of this film. And I don't think they see the... how well it stacks up with the first. So first, he goes north, does that. Second, she goes south. And we see her encounter French nationalism. And I think that's a great balancing act. I think both halves stand up. I think I like the first half better. But
they both halves worked for me. They're different. Film. They're different. But I think the fact that what happens is when she then goes to France, you really get this sense of how war sucks for everybody. That in the end, it's like the French lost their father's sons, brothers. The Germans lost their father's sons, brothers. The nationalism that's going on in the pub or the beer garden, regardless of, you know, wherever you are, it's the same thing that's happening on both sides in both countries. And it just shows that that in this war, ultimately, it's like nobody wins. And, they just question what were they all fighting for. And it's just, it's a very powerful movie, and I did enjoy it.
You surprised me. Because you never like any of what you say your French films.
I know.
Maybe it's because it's only half in French.
It's half French, half German.
All right, our next film is a documentary. And I just want to enter into it by saying I like documentaries when it shows extremely passionate people doing something that they love. And in this one, you see that in, some people call it swing dancing, but apparently that's wrong. It's Lindy hopping, Hannah.
Both.
What did you think of Lindy hopping in Alive and Kicking?
Alive and Kicking, as documentaries go, it was a pretty traditional documentary in its presentation. It's best, as most of these types of documentaries are, my favorite parts are when they're dancing. So when you have music and dancing, it's a very lively, enjoyable documentary. I have a friend who is a huge swing dancer, very into that community.
Lindy Hopper, please.
Lindy Hopper. She will really enjoy this movie because it gives you this backstory of the history of how Lindy hopping and swing dancing, how it basically emerged, I believe it was like in the 1930s in Harlem, and then it went away for a while. And then movies like in the 1980s when VHS tapes were big, and Swingers and Swing Kids and a Gap commercial, you understand why all these different forces combine to sort of bring the Lindy Hop and the swing dancing back into the mainstream, and this community of people that are just absolutely obsessed with swing dancing and love it, and it's their thing, and they will, it's just so important in their lives. And so you meet these very quirky, different kinds of characters that all are on the swing circuit, I suppose. I liked it, but I didn't love it.
No, I didn't love it either, but it showed me a world I'm just completely unfamiliar with. The director, Susan Glatzer, this is her first film. She's actually a studio exec. She went out and made this documentary because she is a Lindy Hopper. And she says people dance to be happy. And there's this whole subset of the film that wants you to ask yourself, if you feel happy, are you doing when your alarm goes off in the morning and you commute and you go to work? And do you have something in your life when you come home that makes you happy? And for whatever reason, it takes a good 10 to 15 minutes out of the film examining on if you feel happy. And that's why these people do this to feel happy. So don't judge. In case you felt like judging, don't judge, because they're doing this to be happy.
Yeah, they use the word joy a lot. And so that is a common thread throughout all the different characters that are introduced. They talk about doing this for the joy. And one of the surprising characters, it's always fun when they drop these things in later. So you start labeling people, I think. And so there's this one guy that you kind of think is a little on the dweeby side. Then it turns out he's a transplant surgeon. And so it's like during the day, he's a transplant surgeon, but he is a dedicated swing dancer and he loves this community. And it's an important part of his life. Then there's two very bizarre sisters. I didn't quite get what was going on with
the Decavita sisters from Sweden.
The Swedish sisters who had adopted each other.
But they're not sisters, but don't tell them that.
Exactly. That was a little weird, but
there's some characters.
There are some characters.
You know, put quotations around characters in this film.
Yeah.
There's interviews with the founders of Lindy Hop. So Frankie Manning, he's like the founder. He's credited. You invented it, sir. Mm-hmm. There's interviews of him. and his favorite dance partner, Norma Miller, the Queen of Swing.
She's funny.
She's, I guess, still around. Yeah. And my favorite character, her name's Evita, and she goes around all over the world, all over the globe, instructing, teaching. And that's, I guess, that's the only way you can make money Lindy Hopping, is to teach and to get famous off of YouTube. And then the people will come ask to fly over to whatever city they're in to instruct their club. And then there's the couple. They're not a couple, but they're a dance couple. Right. Steven and Shanzi.
Yeah, Shanzi.
That really focuses on them. They compete at the highest levels. They come to D.C. every year, I guess, for the nationals. And he's not gay. I didn't. Oh, okay. Because he falls in love with one of the Decavitas.
Because one of the Decavita sisters, yeah. They manage to find, there's always that next documentary that hasn't quite talked about some community that exists, whether it's the chess club or the Mad Hot Ballroom. So, you know, where you go into the ballroom dancers, the ones who are about the crossword puzzle fanatics. So it's for that. It's for people who like to peek inside these communities and these subcultures that exist among us, and why they are so enamored with what they do, and why it becomes such a big part of their life, and why they're so dedicated to it. And it is designed to kind of have you find, and whether it happens to be something like swing dancing, the message that I think the film is sending is that find your thing and embrace it. And it's very important for a holistic existence to find that joy where you can, and to not judge others for what their choices are.
Well, I didn't need a documentary that's actually a shade under 90 minutes, like 88 minutes, to tell me to go find my joy. You know, tell me about the Lindy Hoppers and about its history and its present, maybe its future. You know, don't tell me to go find my joy, and because your film's already a little boring.
It got boring. It definitely dragged in the middle. They interjected New Orleans stuff post Katrina.
That was so out of place.
Did not fit at all. I did not understand
poor
why.
Poor editing on that
It was
too.
Injected, and you felt like it was an afterthought that they had to put that in. And the chronology was definitely very difficult to follow during parts of this movie. And I didn't even know until the very end. You didn't even know that the founder of the Lindy Hop had died.
Spoilers.
No, it's not a spoiler. He died in like 2009, and I just, it was weird to me to not understand where we were at in time with the interviews and with the competitions, and so I did not particularly think it was the best edited in terms of the chronology. And without a doubt, the New Orleans stuff did not fit. They could have easily lifted that, and then it would have been a tighter film.
No, Alive and Kicking will not be one of the year's best documentaries.
No.
It's quirky for people like quirk.
And anyone who is in that swing dancing community,
I don't think you have to tell them. They already know.
They will know, and they should all go and have a little outing and enjoy it, and then go swing dancing afterwards.
So our last film, and it's last for a reason, it's called Queen of the Desert, and it's by a very famous director, both for fiction and documentary, Werner Herzog.
Werner.
The man with the voice, Grizzly Man. We talked about him last year when he did Lo and Behold.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of his, it didn't used to be, but increasingly rare fiction films. He's very famous for stuff like Fitzcarraldo, you know, lugging the cruise ship across the Brazilian jungle. But this one stars Nicole Kidman as she's playing a real-life person, a girl named Gertrude Bell. This takes place, well, all over the place, actually. Way before World War I. It starts in 1898, and it ends after World War I. It was shot, this is very strange, it was shot in like 2013 or 2014. Long time ago. It premiered in Germany in 2015, and in a couple countries around the world last year. And it's finally getting a U.S. release now, like 4 years after it was shot. It's getting released. And I think I know why, because it's not good. There's actually a second Werner Herzog movie is opening this weekend as well in select cities. So there's two Herzog films opening this week.
Well, that explains why Nicole Kidman looks so young.
She looks really young.
She looks incredibly young. And that was what amazed me more than anything, was that she is playing, I believe at the start, she's supposed to be in her early 20s.
Oh, she's supposed to be really, I mean, young.
Young, early
20s. No, she's a debutante, like 17.
She
doesn't pull it off, but
she doesn't pull that off, but she still definitely pulls off as the movie progresses...
Because that's her debutante ball.
Yeah, it was... So how you're supposed to kind of be okay with that when you know that she...
It's a nudge-nudge, wink-wink suspension of disbelief.
But she does look... But she looks amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, because she looks way younger in this film than she does in any of her more recent movies. And,
well, yeah, compared to Lion.
But compared to... I mean, where Lion, she's basically playing her age. Yeah. This one, she's playing, you know, 20 years younger. And more so the makeup and everything, she does manage to carry it. And she's got her relationships in this movie are really with these guys that are significantly younger. I mean, James Franco pops up and Robert Pattinson. She seems to have some sort of flirtation going with the character played by him. And then Damian Lewis, there's a weird flirtation going on at the beginning.
Gay.
Well, maybe that's why, yeah, they make that, but they're buddies, they're friends. And then the Damian Lewis character, Damian Lewis plays this guy, Richard, who also is sort of enamored by Gertrude. And I like him. People remember him mostly from Homeland, but he's fun to watch. So it's an interesting movie about it's a story I certainly was not aware of, that you had this real woman who helped Winston Churchill essentially draw the boundaries for Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Jordan, I believe, for after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, it was a history. It's a big history movie. But it is Gertrude Bell's story is certainly one of those hidden girl power movies that I certainly wasn't aware of. And so for any aspiring cartographer girls out there.
Cartographer girls?
Map?
Hannah?
Map?
Seriously? Are there aspiring cartographer girls out there?
You know, you got Hidden Figures now with the aspiring mathematicians.
Well, that should cover
STEM.
The two people that would probably be interested in this movie. Gertrude Bell, Herzog paints her as this woman in a patriarchal era, the early 1900s, and perhaps the most patriarchal region on the planet, the Middle East. And you have this queen of the desert roaming with her camels and servants from Damascus to present-day Lebanon, down into Saudi Arabia and Jordan. And it wants to be Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes.
You got
the wide... sweeping desert scenes.
Desert shots and sandstorms and look at the camels and the sun is the backdrop. And the score wants to try to sound like Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, my gosh. The score that just never ends. Yeah.
It's got the duplicitous, petty bureaucrats who just don't understand Gertrude Bell. And it's capped off with an overly eccentric and very odd performance by Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
Didn't work for me. He's T.E. Lawrence, very famous man. He was Lawrence of Arabia. And other than Nicole Kidman, the acting in this movie is atrocious. It's awful. Led by Pattinson, second place James Franco. He's terrible.
See, I thought he was
terrible.
Fine. He's not even in it long enough to be terrible.
Well, I do not want people to think that I'm recommending this movie at all just by saying Nicole Kidman holds her own. This movie's terrible.
I didn't find it terrible. I'm not a particularly big fan of Werner Herzog movies. This is it wants to be an epic. It goes a little overboard with the score and with the desert scenes. And but I do like the story. I like the fact that I'm learning something about this true person that existed. My favorite part of this movie was the last 30 seconds, though, where you see the actor, then the real person, and the sort of historical fact card as to what happened to this person. I like true stories, and to learn something like that is good. Well, yeah, I mean, out of the six films that we saw this week, would I really send many people to this? No.
I would send nobody to this, even if they like history.
If they like history...
No way.
I would.
It's just, it's so poorly made. It's almost a farce. That score and those sweeping desert shots and the endless, now I want to go to this town, now I want to go to this town, ooh, I better act like a tough woman in front of this sheikh.
She's the head... See, I think you're seeing her character wrong. I mean, she's this... headstrong woman.
No, I get it. It's pounded into me that she's headstrong.
She's headstrong and passionate about what she's going to set out to do. And no guy is going to keep her down. And she endears herself to these various tribes and wanderers in the desert and the Bedouins and the Druze. And it's very interesting that she's a really skilled barterer. And so she makes all these trades to sort of protect for her safety and the safety of her team. And I do think that from a standpoint of a movie about a very strong woman in history that a lot of people probably were not aware of, for that, I think it's worth noting. Sending people to, probably not. Occasionally, if somebody's interested in that time period and in learning more about this woman's story, then there might be some reason to stick it in their Netflix queue.
If somebody spends time on this, let alone money, because you said it's not, you know, it's for such and such kind of person, they're going to be so mad at you.
I don't know. We'll find out.
Really, one of the worst of the year.
I didn't think it was one of the worst of the year.
All right, there's a movie we didn't see this week because they didn't screen it for us, and I don't know if anybody saw it, and they really never would have because it's one of those, you know, handful of year that religious movies. Next weekend is Easter, therefore, this weekend, on about 1,000 screens, they are releasing a film called The Case for Christ. The Case for Christ.
Hmm.
Last year, it was Risen, starring, you know, I think it was Joseph Fiennes, but yeah, I know nothing about it, and it's coming out on Friday.
That's on more screens than Gifted?
It's on 950 more screens than
that
Gifted.
That is wrong.
You don't know. You haven't seen it. All right. Quick recap. Man, this feels like a long time ago. For kids only. Smurfs. The Lost Village. If your kid drags you to it, say, no, let's go see the Boss Baby instead.
I think the Cool Blue Gatorade is actually better than the film.
Oh, here, here. Going in Style.
Going in Style. If you want to see the dream team of geezer actors for mature audiences recreating a 1979 comedy that was done by George Burns, go for it.
Why would you want to see that? Gifted, emotionally cloying schlock.
With Chris Evans.
France, the best film of the week. It's a hell of a story. You can't go wrong.
I might actually agree with you. I'm sorry.
The documentary Alive and Kicking. It's quirky. It's about Lindy Hopping. Go and learn something.
If you're a swing dancer, definitely see it. And if you want to just figure out how to find your joy and your passion in the world, go see it.
Queen of the Desert. There's a reason it took 4 years to be released this weekend.
I would say just read up on Gertrude Bell. And if her story appeals to you to see it in cinematic form, then maybe. But if you're going in blind, yeah, I would say you can skip it.
Oh, I do not understand you sometimes.
Sometimes.
All right. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on Radio St. Pete.